This episode is brought to you by Ancestry. You can savor your story in a whole new way with Ancestry DNA. With over 350 regions and 2 times the geographic detail of other DNA tests, Ancestry can connect you to the culture, cuisines, and traditions of your heritage in a deeper way. What discoveries will you bring to the table? Ancestry DNA is on sale for just $59 until August 20th. Learn more at ancestry.com/Andrew.
I'm Massimo Bottura.
Hi, this is Amanda Cohen.
This is David Kinch.
This is Mike Anthony.
This is Huni Kim.
This is Amanda Freitag.
This is Richard Blaze.
This is Paul Kahn.
This is Curtis Stein.
This is Stephen Harris.
This is Missy Robbins.
And you're listening to Andrew Talks to Chefs on Heritage Radio. I love change, but change also scares me. So I like that and that sort of element of fear involved in it. Like, what are we going to do in 2 weeks when tomatoes are available? Or it's that thing that's always in your head that always scares you a little bit. That's what I like. Uh-huh. I like the not knowing of what things are going to become, whether it's something that's on the menu or it's completely changing things or X, Y, and Z. I like that sort of fear element and the anticipation of what something could be.
That is Chef Aaron Shambora of Fausto Restaurant in Brooklyn, New York, this week's guest on Andrew Talks to Chefs. Hi, everybody. Welcome to the show. This is Andrew Talks to Chefs. I am your host, Andrew Friedman, here with
Caitlin Friedman.
Caitlin Friedman. Hello, Caitlin.
Good morning, Andrew.
This reminds me this morning of, you know, there was a Monty Python movie years ago where in the middle of a movie, a guy popped up. I think he was wearing a bear suit and he took it off and he said, "Hello, good evening, and welcome to the middle of the movie," or something like that. So
you feel like we're in the middle of the movie?
No, this is good morning, welcome to the end of the season.
Oh.
This is the last episode of the season.
Already?
Yeah. Yeah, we're about to go on our, well, Heritage is going on its summer hiatus. We'll be back mid-September. But I want to quickly tell listeners, please don't fast forward, listeners. And once in a while, I ask you guys not to fast forward. I want to quickly tell you guys, before we introduce our guest, that I have a special offer. And the special offer is I have some episodes for next season already in the bank, as they say. I have part one of an interview with Rocco DiSpirito. I have an interview with Garrison Price, the chef of Il Buco Alimentari e Veneria, who was on our Phil Rosenthal episode. I am interviewing this week Alex Cornicelli. I am interviewing this week Daniela Sota Inez of Cosme and Atla in New York City. Next week, I'm sitting down with Christian Petroni, who just won Next Food Network Star on the Food Network. So here's the deal that I'm going to make with you guys. As you all know, I'm obsessed with ratings and reviews. For every additional, I'm thinking 25, Caitlin.
Okay, that sounds like a good number.
Yeah, doesn't have to be reviews. Ratings, which you just have to punch a button. For every 25 ratings that roll in, between now and the beginning of the next season, which is almost a month away, I will drop a bonus episode. You and I will fire up the recorder, do an intro. David Tatasciore, our engineer, has already agreed to do this for me during the housekeeping period at Heritage, since he will be around. And I will do that. And that's the deal. So if you all would like to take advantage of that, please rate the show, or if you really want to make me extra happy, there's no extra shows for this, but throw up a review. And I will also, as a special added offer, say that if my book, Chefs, Drugs, and Rock and Roll, my book about the chefs of the 70s and 80s, spikes up into the top 1,000 on Amazon, it's been out almost 6 months now, so the number fluctuates wildly. But if it spikes up into the top 1,000, I will drop another episode. This is the opposite of a hostage situation.
Except your interviews are sort of being held hostage.
I guess I'm holding the interviews hostage. Well, anyway. Is that okay, Caitlin? Does it seem mercenary of me?
No, I think that this is fun.
Okay.
So also, I'm really kind of curious about there are a lot of good interviews there.
Yeah. If you want to hear more episodes, if you're checking your queue, if you're like, oh my God, it's a month till the next episode, if you're going on a car trip in August, rate the show and you'll get another episode. Okay. Now, Aaron Shambura is the chef of Fausto. Caitlin, we've been to Fausto a couple of times.
Always had a good time.
Yeah, the food's great. It's a little, they've got a little bit of a ghost because they are in the old Franny's space. I did not bring that up. I don't think I brought it up at all. If I did, it was in passing because the restaurant has quickly established itself very much as its own being. Did you find that? When we were there, I didn't find myself reminiscing. I felt like this was its own animal.
Absolutely did not feel like it was the same space. In fact, until you mentioned that, I'd entirely forgotten that.
Yeah, it's really terrific. Aaron came up working at a range of restaurants, which we'll talk about in the interview, and then dialed in on Italian food at Lartuzzi and some other places. We'll cover all of that. It's a fairly straightforward autobiographical interview. We do talk a little bit more about food than I sometimes do because there were some dishes there that I was curious about, one of which, Caitlin, you'll remember this, the first time we ate there with our friends Lauren and Hervé, we had meatballs, which I thought were the best meatballs I'd ever had.
Oh, yeah.
We actually get into the story behind the meatball. There is a story. It's actually a very interesting story of how they came to be. And I don't think anyone listening to this who heard me say this, you're thinking, oh, it's veal, pork, and beef, you know, the way they do, or, oh, it's whatever the... No, there's actually a story involving Erin's team and herself of how those meatballs came to be that I think is fascinating. So I'm not going to say anything else, Caitlin. I'm going to just ask everybody for the last time this season to imagine themselves it was a hot day when I went there, pulling up in front of Fausto Restaurant in Brooklyn on a sweltering hot day, walking inside, sitting at this nice, big, beautiful corner banquette, which is where we conducted this interview, and you will find me and Aaron beginning our conversation. Here you go.
I think I fell in love with Italian food when I was a teenager.
Uh-huh.
I actually had a trip to Italy where
okay.
I spent
what part?
a week or two. We went to Florence, Rome, Venice, Sorrento.
Nice.
And then from there we went on to Greece.
Uh-huh.
I think that was my first real forte into real Italian food.
Uh-huh.
I did grow up in New Jersey, so
uh-huh.
I'm very used to Jersey Italian, which is amazing, and I still love it. I'll eat chicken parm every day if I could.
I was going to say, this Jersey Italian is like Italian-American at its lusty
yes,
best.
Yes, which is delicious.
Yeah.
I also love it. I think my first trip to Italy really opened my eyes to
uh-huh.
Italian food.
About how old were you?
I was 15.
Okay, so this was a family trip?
No, I was actually a student ambassador. So
what?
It's a program that I had to write essays for and interview for. So we went through Italy and then we went through Greece. I think there were 15 or 16 of us on the trip.
What's a student ambassador?
I'm really not. We didn't really do anything specific. I mean, it was just a tour.
But was this like a UN program or a U.S. government program or
I don't even really remember. My brother had done it. He had gone to Russia for 3 weeks when he was about the same age.
That's timely.
And my parents were like, you should do it. And
yeah.
I was like, Italy, of course.
Yeah.
So it seemed like a great opportunity for me
okay.
to be able to travel.
Did you have to apply for this?
I did. I had to apply. I'm not sure how competitive it actually was, or they just wanted to make sure they had the right people
uh-huh.
on the trip.
Right,
We had to write journals.
Yeah.
And then submit all the journals at the end.
Okay.
It was actually a really amazing trip.
This sounds awesome.
Yeah.
So wait, how long all in?
It was
about.
Almost 3 weeks.
Okay.
So we were a week and a half throughout Italy.
Yeah.
We then went to Greece. We were in Athens. And then we actually did a homestay.
Okay.
In Greece. Just families that took us on. So there were two of us in each house. It was amazing.
Did they speak English?
We lived on the beach. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And then
I've never been to Greece, but everyone talks about the perfect.
It was amazing.
The azure blue waters of Greece.
It's beautiful. I would go back to Greece if I could.
You haven't been back since then?
I haven't been back, no. Oh, my gosh.
So you didn't go over there for food?
No.
But food hit you?
Yes.
How so? What do you remember? What are there dishes that, like, when I just, you remember that trip? Are there dishes that, or moments?
I just remember the really simple, straightforward red sauce and noodles and how good and different it tasted. And then just the simplicity of everything, which is what I love about Italian food to begin with.
Yeah. So you grew up in, you said New Jersey, Bergen, am I right? Bergen County?
Bergen County, yes.
Okay, what town?
Wyckoff.
Okay. And what was your childhood like? Like, was that, is that a, how would we describe that area? Was it like a New York suburban?
It was suburban. Yeah. My parents didn't commute to the city. My parents were both teachers.
Mm-hmm. Grade school?
Yes. My mom was a first grade teacher. My dad was a seventh and eighth grade math teacher.
Okay.
They both worked in the same town.
Okay.
Which is not where I went to school.
Okay.
I went to school in the town, a few towns over.
Okay.
Pretty standard childhood. I was a big soccer player, so most of my time was dedicated to that. So a lot of weekends and extra time was all based on athletics, which was great.
Now, were you, I'm always fascinated by the topic of chefs as kids and their relationship to school. You were the child of two teachers. Mm-hmm. What was your academic life like?
I had a great academic
life. You did?
Yeah.
You were a good student.
Oh, yeah. I didn't mess around. I grew up with two teachers, so I knew not to, you know, mess around at school or mess around with teachers.
Right. And you liked it.
Yeah. I liked school for the most part. You know?
What did you think you were going to do when you grew up?
I wanted to be a history teacher.
Which is what
I studied in college once I got to college.
Uh-huh. So cooking came for you much later as a professional pursuit.
Yes. It actually all came roundabout after I graduated with my bachelor's degree that following summer.
So where'd you go to college?
Providence College.
Uh-huh.
And I was a history and business major.
Uh-huh. And what did you, and you thought you were going to take that and become, so wait a minute, you thought you were going to be a teacher.
I wanted to be a history professor.
Yes. But you also got a business degree.
That was my backup.
Backup to teaching?
Yes.
That is practical.
Yes. that was a suggestion of my parents.
Okay.
And I didn't, I did well in the business classes, but it definitely wasn't a direction I thought I'd ever.
A little dry?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, I liked writing papers. I liked reading books.
Was there a part of history that you zeroed in on?
Not really. I was sort of all over the place. My favorite course in college was definitely a class I took about the Vietnam War. Which is every class that all the history majors had to sort of fight to get into. So that
really? Was that because of the topic, or was there a professor who was known as being particularly?
It was both.
Yeah.
The professor was amazing.
Someone who could like really bring it to life.
Yeah. And
those history teachers are, we had someone, when I went to school, I went to school at Columbia, and there was a class called the History of the City of New York. And the guy, I mean, you just went in and it was like theater.
Right.
It's amazing when you have someone like that.
I had a similar teacher in high school.
Yeah.
And in college that were just absolutely amazing.
Okay. So you get out of college, and how do you make this detour.
Right.
Into the kit. What happens?
Well, my senior year was 9/11.
Okay.
And then a few months later, a good guy friend from school passed away.
Mm-hmm.
So all of our worlds were sort of shaken.
Mm-hmm.
Towards the time I would have been applying for my master's, I was hesitant about doing it.
Mm-hmm.
So I called my brother and I said, I don't know if I want to do this. He's 4 years older, so obviously I call him for advice.
You had an existential crisis.
Yes, pretty much. And he's like, so don't apply. He's like, figure it out. You're graduating in a few months. It's going to be fine. So throughout senior and junior year, I would often cook meals for the roommates in the houses we lived in. And it was about everyone coming together and gathering and eating together and sharing a meal, which is what I love about food.
Yeah.
So after graduation, I attended a handful of graduation parties in Chicago. And I was like, guys, I think I want to go to culinary school. And they're like, do it. So I got home. I went online. I applied to the New York Restaurant School, and I started in September.
So as a young person, you were suddenly thinking about mortality, what your life was about, and this thing that you thought was going to cut it for you just seemed like the wrong. It was like walking down the aisle with the wrong person.
Right.
Right? You just had this moment of no.
Right.
Now, had cooking been something in the background that you had sort of pondered but thought, no, that's not, you know, I'm going to be a professor. This is not what I'm like. Had you fleetingly thought about it before that?
No, it was just what I loved. Yeah,
something fun.
Exactly.
Yeah,
and I would just cook really simple things that my mom would cook that I was comfortable doing.
Okay,
that I loved that she made.
Was it stuff that you learned from her? Did you have cookbooks? How did you go about the instructional part of cooking at home?
It was something just simple meals like lemon chicken. Which mm-hmm. really easy. Stuff that she had learned from recipes, nothing uh-huh. that was passed down
right.
from my grandmother to my mother or anything along those lines. It was stuff that was easy to put on the table.
Yeah.
And that everyone loved.
Uh-huh. It was mostly in group settings?
Yes. Both years I lived with 7 or 8 roommates between 3-level houses.
Uh-huh.
So it would be dinners at 7, everyone. If you can make it, make it. And then I would cook everything, and then they would do the dishes.
Yeah.
Which is the best part about cooking is when
right.
someone else does
the
dishes.
But I mean, the motivating factor for you or a big part of it was the communal nature of it.
Yes. I think I really fell in love with food actually before college, or uh-huh. restaurants at least before college,
yeah.
because I was a server at a restaurant.
And you bartended as well, no?
Yes.
I used to love bartending.
I had so much fun when I was a bartender.
Talk to me. This is the most, it's only been 10 minutes, but all of a sudden you like, there's this whole new energy about you. Tell me about the bartending.
I had a great time.
Where was this?
It was at a steakhouse in Wayne, New Jersey. I used to work at a place called Charlie Brown Steakhouse. But it was great. I love serving. And it was at a time where whatever money you made, you kept.
Uh-huh.
So it was about the hustles about, I worked for 4 months a year, so basically during the summers, and then on Christmas break from college.
Uh-huh.
And bartending was just great. It was nice to have that interaction with the bar regulars that I had.
Uh-huh. I was just going to ask if you had regulars.
Yeah, it was just fun.
It was fun.
A great time. I mean,
Highly social.
Yes. And it wasn't difficult, but the camaraderie of the servers, and then when I was a server years before that, just how the family orientation of the restaurant between the front and the back of house and everyone hanging out together after work. So
you worked in a place where front of house and back of house got along?
Yes.
There wasn't that divide. Yeah.
No.
Which can happen.
Yes, 100%.
When you were a bartender and it would get busy, which I'm assuming it did, something like if you were working a Saturday night or something mm-hmm. like that, is there any, I think you're the first person at least I know of who's been on the show who bartended. But is there a correlation between that and service in a kitchen?
You only have to multitask.
Yeah.
You have to be thinking what's coming next or what could be coming.
Uh-huh.
I'm definitely a very organized person.
Yep.
So being able to organize and keep moving is something that comes very natural to me. So I can see how they coincide with one another.
Right.
Especially in a restaurant where a lot of bartenders also have to do the element that the servers are doing.
Right.
So they're thinking about getting the food and making the drinks and making sure they're making things or pouring drinks or making things for the restaurant.
Yeah.
I think the multitasking part definitely coincide with one another for sure.
So you go to the New York Restaurant School.
Yes.
How long a program is that?
About a year.
Okay. So pretty short.
Yes,
relatively
it was
speaking.
Short.
Was that appealing to you?
Yes.
Okay.
I just wanted to start working.
Okay. So was that, it was really like you do learn the fundamentals and then
they set you out in the world.
Yeah.
I was fortunate enough that I had made a good relationship with the career service team.
Yeah.
And my externship, I ended up doing at WD-50.
Right.
The first year, 6 months they were open.
Really?
So it was a very exciting time because her brother had been a sous chef.
Okay.
So I had actually was supposed to do my externship someplace else.
Yeah.
They changed their mind or had taken on too many externs.
Right.
So I was devastated that I couldn't work
right.
wherever that was.
Yeah.
And then she's like, I got a good place for you. And that was WD-50.
So it was already open.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
I think it was towards the end of the first year I was there.
Okay. What was it like? That place, there was a lot of attention on that place when it
there
opened.
There was.
Because Wiley had done the, 71 Clinton?
Yes.
Which got a lot of play, but was really just sort of, I think, figuring out what he was all about there. And then he kind of went full-blown Wiley at WD.
Right.
What was it like to be there at that time?
Terrifying.
Terrifying?
Yes.
Because why? Because
I didn't know anything.
Uh-huh.
I really didn't. I came out of school, and I knew when I came out of school that I knew just the basics.
Right.
Which was fine, which is all I wanted to get out of it. And then I walked into a place that's doing all of this crazy stuff.
Yeah.
That I'd never seen.
Yes.
It was very intimidating. But they kept it real. I mean, I peeled onions and shallots and garlic.
Yeah.
And I did just that for weeks.
Uh-huh.
And then it would move to, then let's clean squid and learn how to do that. And reorganize the walk-in.
Right.
And, I mean, it was an externship for sure.
Right.
Towards the end, I was fortunate enough to be able to be on the line and help cook.
Uh-huh.
But still looking back on that, it was terrifying.
Yeah. Well, when you say you didn't know anything, I mean, there's always a gap between school and real world restaurants, right? That anybody will tell you. But what you, I think part of what you meant, if I'm making the right assumption, was, and you sort of just alluded to it, that, and I think everyone listening to this probably knows this, but that, I know Wiley hates the term, but that was at the time, people would have said that was a molecular cuisine.
Yes.
That was the term.
Right.
He doesn't like that. But that is kind of what it was. It was probably the only one really of its kind in New York, strangely. I assume you also, at the New York Restaurant School, there was no class in additives, right? There was no class in,
foam and xanthan
gum
that.
And what's the meat glue? I forget what it starts with the
Bar
T.
Gum?
Nah, try something, or I forget, where you can take two pieces of meat and it activates the proteins and they attach to each other and you can make your own shapes and all that stuff that Wiley was doing, right?
Right.
That's about as opposite from what you end up doing as I could think.
100%.
So did you have a sense that you talked about this sort of exciting trip you took overseas when you were 15, getting turned on to Italian food. When you go to cooking school, when you get out and you go take that job, did you have your sights set on Italy as the type of food you were going to explore, or had you not gotten that far in your own planning yet?
I hadn't gotten that far in my plan for how I saw where the future was going to go.
Okay.
My initial reaction was French.
Okay.
Because that was mostly what we had studied at school.
That's
we didn't really have regional.
Yeah.
We didn't have classes based on countries or different places. It was, let's get the basics down.
Yeah.
And we'll talk a little bit about other countries and what they do or Italian food, but there wasn't any focus on things other than French.
Does it startle you how quickly things have changed in that regard? Like you look at the French Culinary Institute, right? And that's now the International Culinary Center.
Right.
And there's an Italian division and there's the, you know, it did, when it's not that long ago that you were in school.
No.
And it was still all French pretty much. And even, you know, the CIA now has, I mean, a lot of these schools now have gone international in a way that they didn't before.
I think it's great. I think it opens up their students' eyes to see more than one thing.
Right.
I learned it as I went through working, which was also, which was wonderful for me.
Yeah.
I also don't necessarily know what direction I would have taken it if I had had those different classes.
Right. Something else might have gotten your attention.
Right.
Okay.
I mean, I always loved Italian food. Yeah. I didn't think it was going to be the path I was going to take.
Yeah.
I went to Mercer Kitchen, which was French-based.
Which is a Jean-Georges restaurant.
Yes. I truly fell in love with Italian food at Del Posto.
Mm-hmm.
Working with Mark Ladner and seeing how it could be elevated to something beautiful and amazing, but still have that simple feel to it.
Yeah. So that was the... You went WD-50...
Mercer Kitchen.
Mercer, for how long, roughly?
3 years, a little
That's
over 3 years.
That's a long time.
Well, I had gone through every station.
Yeah.
They made me a sous chef.
Yeah.
And then I stayed for another year.
Why'd you want to go to Del Posto?
Cruz Goulier, who was the co-executive at Mercer at the time, who made me a sous chef.
Yeah.
I really connected with him.
Uh-huh.
He left. So he made me a sous chef. We worked together for, as me and management, we worked together a month or two, and then he left.
Yeah.
Which was very disappointing.
Yeah.
But great for me because he went to Del Posto.
Uh-huh.
So when I had reached my sort of the what I thought was the end of my time at Mercer, I couldn't advance anymore. there had been a lot of changes in management and chefs that I didn't really want to work with anymore.
Yes.
And he was my first call. He's like, well, there's an opening. We have open stations, so why don't you come and trail?
Uh-huh.
And that's sort of how it all happened.
Got it. Okay. And how far into that restaurant's life do you get there?
A little less than a year.
Oh, wow.
Because I started a month into when they just gotten the Michelin star.
Okay. And before the four stars.
Yes.
Yeah. So what's, you said the food, the sort of dichotomy, I guess, of what Mark was doing there between it. Well, why don't you just expand on what you said? What struck you about it, the food there?
It was just so beautifully done, and his shifts on traditional dishes and the pasta program and everything just about that entire experience was amazing. I mean, how the kitchen was set up, the entire kitchen from the production kitchen downstairs, which had walk-ins that were refrigerated, so that's where all the fish and the meat was butchered. And it was just an eye-opening experience to find. That was my first fine dining experience as well.
What else about the kitchen organization struck you?
It was by far the biggest kitchen I'd ever worked in. And all the meat and the fish line, you faced one another.
Okay.
So you could see everyone working, as opposed to just a straight line.
Yeah.
You could see the stations you were working across from.
Okay.
Which was really exciting. I mean, I still have memories or nightmares about hearing the timers go off because everything ran on timers. Because if you had the risotto, you needed to know when the risotto was going off, if it was plated with a meat dish, or just how large that space was and how many sous chefs were there. And, it's by far the biggest kitchen I've ever worked in.
When you say timers, people had on their wrists, they had magnetic or
magnetic.
Something that stuck to the
but
steel.
they weren't the little timers that, for instance, we use here that I'm used to. They were larger ones that you could put five different settings on.
You yourself could?
Yes.
So, okay.
So
did people have their own, like, the whatever, ringtone or sound?
No, they all made the same
sound.
They were stationary built-in timers.
I could see why you would have nightmares about
this. So between the
this.
Timers and then the ticket printing.
Yeah.
that I definitely had dreams and nightmares about that
every time you heard a bell go off, you had to look and see if it was yours? Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, you knew when
this
your
is like
timer
Tony
was
Soprano
coming.
In the last scene of The Sopranos.
Right.
Like every time the door opens.
Exactly.
Do you actually still have nightmares? You're not exaggerating.
Not about Del Posto, but every time I started a new restaurant, the first month or so, it's the sound of the timers going off or the tickets printing always sort of... something at night, whether it's right when I'm falling asleep or right when I wake up, I can always hear that timer and how that printer sounds.
Right. Okay.
Which sounds really strange. I think it's an anxiety part of starting in a new place.
Can we talk about Mark for a second?
Sure.
I don't know him well. I've interviewed him once, but what you said about him makes total sense to me because he was at Lupa, which is basically a trattoria.
Mm-hmm.
Then he goes and opens this fancy Italian place, like as fancy as it got for Italian food in New York. And then he's now opened this, I guess we call it a fast casual, probably pasta flyer concept. But he's this super adaptable person. And so it makes sense to me when you say that it was this sort of fancified Italian, but that hadn't lost the soul of what makes Italian food Italian food.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of presence was he?
I mean, he was a force.
Yeah.
When he walked, I mean, everyone stood up straight in that kitchen regardless, but I mean, he was always there.
Yeah.
And it was always, and he was also very subtle. I always felt like I knew he was watching what I was doing.
Right.
From regardless of where he was. And there were a lot of people in that kitchen.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I definitely stood up even more straight.
Right.
Made sure everything was correct.
Yeah.
It was nice interacting with him if he came over.
Yeah.
He was also a very busy guy. There were a lot of people, and there were a lot of things to watch in a big space. So he was all over the place.
Yeah.
But it was great working with him. Yeah.
Did you like the bigness? Did you like that aspect of it?
I did. That size and that scale of a restaurant, I'm glad that I got to work there, but it was definitely not where I was going to end up.
Right.
So many moving parts.
Yeah.
I wouldn't change that experience for anything because it did lead me into working at Lupa.
Uh-huh.
Which was a great time for me.
Yeah.
But yeah, that size was just, thinking about it now, it just seems massive compared to...
Not what you wanted.
Not what
I
wanted.
But a good experience.
Yeah. It definitely drove me in the direction of me sort of realizing what I wanted out of a kitchen.
Uh-huh.
And the size restaurant that I wanted to work in.
That can be as... Can it not be as valuable to see the thing you don't want as it is to see the thing you do want? Like, I've had a lot of people tell me, cooks and chefs, that they learned more working for somebody who was awful because they knew they didn't want to be that.
Right.
I hear that all the time. And sometimes I hear it as much as I hear the role model.
100%. I think a lot of how people manage, you remember that person that wasn't the greatest manager or wasn't the best boss.
Yeah.
Or it sort of fuels you to that moment where you're like, I don't want to be like that person.
Right.
So when I have to deal with this situation, how would I deal with it?
Right.
I think you learn a lot from the not so great experiences.
Yeah.
For sure. I think you learn about what you don't want to do.
Yeah.
Which is just as important of when you work with someone that you really respect and that you really want to emulate. There's a lot that I've learned throughout my time.
Yeah.
Good and bad.
Yeah.
That have now made me realize when I deal with situations, right, how to deal with them.
As you rise, up through the ranks at these different restaurants, and as you see these different styles, you said you went to Lupa after that, which is, again, for people who haven't been there, it's basically, I think it is described by the company as a trattoria,
right.
I think. It's much more casual, traditional food. When do you start to have a sense of what Aaron's food is going to be? Like, what... Because you started a little bit later. You know, a lot of people who get into this started as a teenager, even
right,
if it's just as a dishwasher and prep cook. You started after college. So you hadn't been thinking about this as long as a lot of your peers, right?
Right.
So when do you get to that point where you start whatever it is, in a notebook or on an iPad or in a file? Like, when do you start thinking about your own dishes or trying stuff at home or being able to put your own specials on? Like, when does that phase start for you?
Probably towards my year in Lupa,
uh-huh,
where I was able to start to put specials on the menu.
Okay.
I didn't come up with menu items. I assisted with putting on menu items.
Uh-huh.
At the time, I was asked a lot to help with that.
Yeah.
And then a lot of times the chef would go in a different direction, which was fine because it gave me the opportunity to be creative and try things, which a lot of people aren't. Not that I was forced to do it, but it was a good time for me to try to get what was happening in my head down in a plate and then to execute it properly for 200 covers.
Right.
So my first experience with that was at Lupa.
Yeah.
And then at Lartusi was where I was really able to shine and do things where I was putting on menu items and we were doing weekly specials.
Yeah.
So I dabbled a little bit at Lupa.
Yeah.
And then it really opened up for me at Lartusi.
Uh-huh. And when were you there?
I was at Lartusi in 2010.
Okay. And what are some things, do you remember the first things that you got put on a menu or your first dishes where you were sort of like, that's who I am?
It might have been when I started to do the short ribs.
Mm-hmm.
It had started because Gabe Thompson, who was the chef at the time, we were doing a dinner that someone had bid on at an auction. So we were doing a dinner at their apartment.
Every chef's favorite thing.
They have their moments. They're fun. And then you're like, wow, I'm cooking in someone's apartment for 25 people on this roof.
I interviewed this British chef once. I forget who it was. But he was talking about doing the out-of-house events. And he said, I think it's the most perfect line. Chefs will agree to anything at a distance.
That's funny.
It's like if you ask a chef to do anything nine months out, they're like, sure.
Yeah. You're like, oh, I totally have time for that.
Yeah.
And then when you rethink that, when you're like, I totally did have time 9 months ago,
right,
and now it's 2 days before,
right,
and X, Y, and Z has happened, and now you don't have time for it.
Yeah.
You do make time, but
Anyway, so the short rib.
So it was probably the first 6 months I was there, and Gabe would very frequently say, I want to do something with short ribs. Do you have anything? I was like, all right, I'll figure something out. And I based a recipe off of my mom's pot roast, which sounds weird, but it ended up all sort of working. And I let him taste it. And he's like, this is amazing. We're going to do this at this person's apartment.
Uh-huh.
So great. And then that trickled into, let's put this on the menu as a special, or let's put this as a verbal special, which is great. And then it ended up being a menu item that every winter I tweaked a little bit, but every winter we then ran it.
Can we talk about this for a minute? Tell me about your mom's version.
My mom's pot roast, very simple.
I'm assuming not Italian in style.
No, not at all.
Yeah.
Just seared meat,
uh-huh.
like roughly cut seared vegetables. And then it just slowly cooked. But this the smell, it was a one pot dinner.
Yeah.
But just the smell of that.
Yeah.
There are certain smells from my mom's kitchen that I just love. Uh-huh. Like that or like a roasting chicken.
Uh-huh.
A roast, something about roast chicken and chicken stock, something always sends me right back to my parents' house.
Got it. So how do you go when the first, if you, as much as you remember, the first iteration for this out-of-house dinner, what do you do? How do you start to spin that? How do you adapt that?
To then for the restaurant?
Yeah. Or for what you did for that benefit, you know, that charity, the auction dinner.
Oh, we got in boneless short ribs.
Yep.
Seasoned salt and pepper sear.
Yeah.
Just a very classic braise.
Yep.
In goes the mirepoix.
Uh-huh.
Caramelize that up.
Yeah.
Add in red wine.
Yeah.
A little bit of tomato.
Yeah.
And
actual tomato?
No, pureed tomato.
Uh-huh.
And then some, actually used chicken stock because we didn't use any beef stock at Lartusi.
Is that right?
Yeah, no beef stock.
Why is that?
I don't know. We just never did.
Just a Gabe thing?
Yeah.
Okay. I love that. I love those little things.
And then everything, the meat back in.
Yeah.
And then just in the oven.
Okay.
And cooked for 3 hours, three uh-huh. and a half hours.
Yeah.
Till it's fork tender.
Yeah.
When you take the meat out, you let it cool.
Yeah.
So then you can trim off some of the fat and then cut it into whatever portions you want.
Okay.
And then we would strain out some of the liquid and then mill the vegetables. So that would be the sauce that went with it.
Uh-huh.
And then just over polenta.
Great. Yeah.
Because that's perfect combination.
Right. So how much of the cooking of that is in the moment, seasoning, tasting, I mean, obviously not while it's braising, but like that last step you described?
It all, tasting everything, the sauce before you put the meat back in is a really important part.
Yeah.
It's developing flavors from the beginning. It's as if when you make soup, you got to start from the bottom up with seasoning.
Right.
Or it's just never quite right. Or or sometimes it falls flat.
Yeah.
So making sure you're seasoning the meat properly and then the vegetables and then continuing to taste before the meat goes back in before it goes in the oven.
Okay.
But then for pickup, everything is portioned, so you're able to heat it.
Yeah.
There isn't quite that much finesse going on for the pickup wise.
Yeah.
Because all the love happens in the morning.
All the love happens in the morning. Okay. That's great. And how did you change it over? I mean, when you say little tweaks over the years, like what kind of thing?
Adjusting the sauce, adding more wine or adding more tomato, changing how the consistency of the sauce. So in the beginning, it was super rustic. So it was adding Parmesan cheese in the beginning to finish, then adding a gremolata.
Wait, adding Parmesan cheese in the beginning?
No, adding in the beginning of
the
first step. Okay. Like the first time we put it on, we'd be like, let's sprinkle the Parmesan.
Got it.
Because that seems natural and delicious, which was beautiful. And then maybe adding a fresh gremolata or adding freshly ground horseradish and dried lemon and dried parsley. Just like subtle tweaks.
Yeah.
That's just how dishes sort of evolve over time.
Yeah.
But that's how it ended. It ended with the gremolata, with the horseradish.
Do you still tinker like that as time goes by with your own stuff?
With evolution of dishes?
Yeah.
Oh, 100%.
You do?
Yeah. I think that's what makes dishes things exciting is that they're constantly evolving. And you take something that you love and you're like, how can I make this even better?
Right.
If you continue to keep it on the menu.
Right. Okay. Is that a dish, is the short rib, did that follow you here?
No.
No?
Mm-mm.
It's the intellectual property of Lartusi?
No, I'm thinking about for the fall and the winter to do something along those lines here. But there were some things that I, especially since we opened in December, it would have been easy for me to be like, let's just do short ribs here.
Yeah.
But this was more about doing what is Fausto and different from what we didn't want to redo L'Artusi here. I didn't want to redo what I'd already done. That was my food, but it was also someone else's food.
Yeah. Well, that's the when you're cooking with, for however you want to describe it, someone else, there is that thing where you can kind of be creative, but you kind of have to stay in their lane, right? That's ultimately, you have to stay within the character of that restaurant.
Right, because the last thing you want to do is put a dish on the menu that has 17 ingredients in it, and there's microgreens, and that doesn't, that item sticks out if you have a table order. Yeah. And you're like, well, that's delicious, but that really doesn't look like it makes sense.
Right. My theme song and break music is from After School Specials album Double Barrel Single Entendre, which is available on iTunes. This episode is brought to you by Ancestry. You can savor your story in a whole new way with Ancestry DNA. And Caitlin, as I mentioned in last week's episode, I took the Ancestry DNA test, and I now have my results.
I'm so jealous and really curious at the same time.
Well, Caitlin?
Yes?
You are married to a Jewish man.
No way.
It's true. I am. According to the DNA analysis from Ancestry, 94% European Jewish. That includes areas like Belarus, Hungary, Lithuania, the Netherlands, and Serbia, which makes special sense because my maternal grandfather's last name was Serbin.
I have relatives that are obsessed, as you know, with family trees, right? Can you imagine how into this they would be?
I know, it's amazing. So the way Ancestry works is, they have these markers for specific areas, and it gives you this sort of encyclopedia-like description of the history of your people in that area and what they call migrations. Now, this part was really cool for me because I know that my parents met on a blind date in New York City through connections in the garment industry, which happened to be both of their family's businesses. And through Ancestry, I learned that in the 1875 to 1900 time period, many people of my great-grandparents' generation fled Europe and found work in the garment industries in a city like Philadelphia, which is where my father and his family were from.
That is so cool.
The other thing for me is I always say this is a chef show, not a food show, but looking at this map and thinking about the cuisines of Eastern Europe, I am drawn to these foods on a really basic level. It's not terribly complicated food, but it's very soulful. And my family wasn't very food savvy when I was growing up, but there were definitely remnants of the food of these regions. And I've always felt what I would call a kinship with it. So I had an amazing experience with Ancestry, and I would encourage listeners to check it out for yourselves. It's a lot of fun, and it's fascinating. Now you too can discover the culture, cuisines, and traditions of your heritage in a deeper way. Ancestry DNA is on sale for just $59 until August 20th. That's not far from now, so you should jump on that. Learn more at Ancestry.com/Andrew. That's Ancestry.com/Andrew. Otherwise, Caitlin, I think we said the stuff we usually say in this space at the top of the show with our hostage negotiation.
I think we're done then.
We're pretty much done. I will say one more time, if you have any suggestions for the show, I have said this before, please put them in the comments on Instagram. Our Instagram handle is @chefpodcast, or on the Facebook page for the show. Or you can email me. I'll give out my email address again. It's Andrew@Toqueland, TOQUELAND.com. That's Andrew@Toqueland.com. If you have any comments, suggestions, improvements you want to fly by me, guests that you'd love to hear, changes in format, I am open to anything. We do spend a lot of time thinking about this show. People will remember, if you've been listening from the beginning, the opening montage is new.
this year. That was not part of the original show. The teaser at the beginning of the show that lets people know who the guest is right off the bat, that is something that did not happen before. I used to interrupt the interviews to say, let's go to break, until a listener from Israel suggested to me that I don't do that since it's not a live situation. So now the interviews are flow, I think, much better. There's no, they're unbroken as they're recorded. That's all stuff that came from you all. So anything else you want to suggest, I'm not very thin-skinned. So just go ahead and let me know what you think. I'd really like to hear it. I want the show to be as good as it can be. Okay, with that, let's get back to the rest of our interview with Chef Aaron Shambura at Fausto Restaurant in Brooklyn. I hope you enjoy the rest of it. How did this restaurant come about for you? What was your vantage point for the whole creation of it?
The story is, yeah, I had left L'Artusi and was going to spend 3 months with my boyfriend, who's now my husband at the time, in Italy.
Uh-huh. Where?
In Italy, in the Veneto. We stayed. Okay. We had an apartment in Treviso, which is about 30 kilometers from Venice.
You own an apartment there?
No. Oh, my God. Okay. I wish.
I thought you said we have an apartment
no,
there.
No, that's where we had our apartment.
Oh, okay.
Or we rented an apartment.
Like, you're doing pretty well.
I wish. So I left L'Artusi, which is where I met Joe, and I worked with Joe.
Yeah.
I took a month off in between leaving L'Artusi and going to Italy.
Mm-hmm.
A week before we left, Joe called me and said, "What are you doing in the fall? I have some ideas that I want to, you know, speak with you about over the next few months."
Mm-hmm.
At that point, I said, "I have no idea. I just quit my job. I'm picking up my entire life and moving to Italy for a few months." He was like, "Okay." He then started to look for spaces.
Yep.
And then found one he really liked.
Yep.
And reached out to me and asked if this would be something I'd want to do.
Yeah.
At that point, I didn't know.
Yeah.
It gave me something to think about, and that's what I let him know.
Uh-huh.
Then he just sort of kept trying to set up conversations and emailing me, and then it turned into we're speaking once a week.
Mm-hmm.
And then he was looking at more spaces, and I just kept thinking about it the entire time.
Yep.
Which I didn't have a plan for when we returned. We left in June. We got back in September. I had no plan once we left what was going to happen. I didn't know if we were coming back to New York.
Yep.
I didn't know what I was going to be doing.
Yep.
So Joe definitely gave me a lot to think about.
What were you doing in Italy? Like, were you cooking over there? Were you just chilling out?
We were just chilling out.
Okay.
We were just eating and drinking.
Okay.
I didn't stage in any kitchens. It was more about immersing ourselves in a different culture and atmosphere and lifestyle.
Uh-huh.
So we just sort of hung out all summer.
Was it great?
It was amazing.
Yeah.
Went to Barcelona for a week. I mean, we went down, we traveled, we went to Florence.
Mm-hmm.
We spent some time in the Dolomites. We have some friends over there. We spent a lot of time with them.
You got good and lost.
Oh, seriously lost.
Yeah. That's great.
It was eye-opening. It was refreshing.
Yeah.
We both needed a break from New York because he's also in the industry.
That was my next question. When I hear that you could both take time off together.
Yeah.
Cook, front of the house?
Front of house,
okay.
Bartender. He had been at Gramercy for a little under 3 years.
Okay.
When he decided, we were both sort of at our limit.
Yeah.
With New York. So our escape was, let's just go to Italy.
Okay.
So we did.
Okay. So the space, was that the space we're sitting in now? Or was that a different space?
It's a different space.
Okay.
So
was it always Brooklyn?
Yes.
Okay.
Always Brooklyn.
Okay.
We wanted to do something within the community that we were both living in.
Okay.
Joe, we both live within walking distance of here.
Okay.
Which was very important. I'd only ever worked in restaurants in the West Village, which I love. I love the West Village.
Right.
I was tired of commuting to the city. I didn't want to do it.
Yeah.
I wanted to be living and working in the community where I wanted it all to be happening at the same place.
Okay. Interesting.
Mm-hmm.
So how does, when does this space come up?
We ended up getting this space in April of 2000. We started talking with Franny and Andrew at the end of April.
Okay.
Of 2017.
Okay.
So things all started happening from there. I mean, we had looked at a ton of spaces from September until April and couldn't find anything. So Francine had contacted Joe. Because they knew we were looking for a space. And it just sort of all happened quickly after that. It was finalizing the agreement. It was when they were going to be done. When they wanted to move. So we started talking the end of April. Things got moving really quickly. And I mean, between that time and when we signed the lease, we'd had everything designed and ready to go. We had our GC. So it was just sort of finalizing the paperwork.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
So you, tell me, how did you two talk about it? I mean, you just talked, when I asked you about that, bringing that dish, you said, no, I wanted to, you know, the food here to be what Fausto was about, right? So how, what was Fausto about? Like, how did you and Joe, how did he first talk to you about it? And then how, what was your, what was the sort of verbal dance around, you know, the concept?
We talked a lot about our business plan together. It was important that we were both on the same page. So a lot about, it was, let's open something in Brooklyn. Great. Okay. Then it was, let's open it within a community that we love. Awesome. Then let's have a really approachable yet dynamic wine program. And have Amaro's, which we both really love. Then it was, let's be seasonal. Which was difficult in the beginning because we opened in December. So nothing is really super local. But doing local seasonal food. And that's just sort of where everything sort of, that, that was the basis of what our plan was.
How did you go about conceiving the menu here?
It was really a culmination of a lot of my experiences working in New York. A lot of it being my love for traditional. Italian food, which is where I really got out of my time at Lupa, which is Roman-based. And then seeing how it could be twisted into something based on your interpretation of how Gabe did it at L'Artusi, which was, he was born and grew up in Texas, so he liked chilies and spice, and that was his interpretation. I sort of took the two and then brought them here. I wanted to do things that were really ingredient driven. So the main ingredient really shines in what the dish is. So I love heat and I love chilies, but it wasn't what I wanted to do here because that's, that was Gabe's interpretation of it. So I really took, I think I took a nice balance of the two. And just eating throughout Italy to then develop what this menu is, which I think is approachable. And it's simple in the way that simple is also difficult. So making sure that the six things that go into something are done and executed perfectly.
There's nowhere to hide.
No, there's nowhere to hide when there's only four things in a dish.
What for you was the biggest challenge of conveying what you want and your food? When you talk about food like that, right? My impression to someone who's never been a chef is that the role of, or the part of the job that you do that's teaching becomes even more important because it's not just following a recipe. You really need to teach. I mean, you do, you need to do this in any kitchen, but you really need people who kind of get the food at almost a molecular level. Does that make sense? Like when you're dealing with so few ingredients, to make that sing, to make it look like something, to make it taste right, you need people who have great palates and you need people who have incredible taste memory and get you. I mean, I don't know how else to put it. It's something to me that probably in some ways goes beyond words to really, you just need people who either get it or they don't.
I think, I mean, I think we've been really fortunate here with our cooks are really passionate about what they're doing and really want to learn. It took a lot of doing over and over again in the beginning, especially since we started with, this is the first experience where I've started with no menu and no support. It was me coming up with these dishes and then evolving them into what the first menu was, for sure. But a lot of it is just about repetition. It's about not only taste, but touch. You can feel the noodle, bite the noodle. Like, it was a lot about repetition in the beginning. And then over the first month,
Yeah.
Because we had a few weeks with the cooks before we actually opened for friends and family, which mm-hmm. was great. So it was a lot about getting to know each other, yep. sort of what makes people tick. And then I think it was after a few solid weeks of being open for service where they got to really know me and how mm-hmm. things were done.
Yeah.
Where they all just really latched onto it. We have a great opening crew here.
Mm-hmm.
But it's just about repetition and making sure everyone's tasting everything. Mm-hmm. We go through so many tasting spoons because people are constantly tasting uh-huh. everything.
Yeah.
So it's just about doing it and just over and over and over again.
Uh-huh. In the time since you've been opened, how has it changed? How is what you do here, what are the tweaks?
I think one of the biggest things is getting to learn more about the wood ovens.
Mm-hmm.
I'd never worked with them before,
so
it was definitely a big challenge in the beginning
uh-huh.
Of what to execute from them.
Okay.
Because it wasn't in the initial plan of when I was drawing up menus.
Okay.
So when we got the space, it was, oh my God, now I have to scratch all that. And now, not scratch all of it, but then rethink.
Yeah.
Because... I'd never worked with them, so the first thing I did was come in and light one and just...
You just did it on your own.
Yeah.
You didn't go
the day we
you
signed,
didn't go to some friend's kitchen and say...
Nope, the day we signed the lease, I came in by myself and I lit the oven.
Really?
Yep.
Okay.
And then it
was... there some wood left behind?
There was some... Yeah, there was a lot of wood left behind, which
That's
was great.
Great.
So I got to play around with
them. So you were the only one in the space?
Yeah.
You came in and you lit it and what? Did you even bring in food or you just wanted to see like
how hot it
got?
I just wanted to light it. I was like, I have to get in there. I want to light it.
It was between you and the stove.
Yeah. It was between me and the fire.
And what was that like? Was it hotter than you? I mean, I'm curious about this.
I mean, I didn't
this
light, a, big, like I didn't light a I didn't light a big fire. Yeah. It was just a little one. I wanted to see what it looked like, how long it would take to heat.
How fast it burnt out.
Right. Yeah. And then I lit it. And then I went, it was when it was still Franny. So a lot of the stuff was still here.
Yeah.
So then I went through stuff and then I let it die down and I left. So that uh-huh. was my first sort of like, I need to have this personal moment with these ovens.
I love that.
Which was great. And I remember sending Joe and Alyssa pictures.
Uh-huh.
I was so excited.
You weren't intimidated. I mean, you had to be a little.
I was definitely intimidated. I was like, I got to figure these ovens out.
So that was like step one of you in the oven.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And now we're becoming friends.
You're the oven whisperer.
Yes. It's been a great learning experience of, okay, let's do just proteins in them. And then we'll do the vegetables that mm-hmm. go along with the proteins mm-hmm. in them, but in a different capacity.
Right.
So what we, for instance, we keep the ovens stay warm throughout the night. So if you put the door on them, they stay warmer. So now, months later, we are slow roasting onions in there that go on the chicken set. Or now, most recently, I'm slow roasting some tomatoes that then go on the new ravioli. It's now more about how many things I can do in those ovens.
Mm-hmm.
From where in the beginning, it was so daunting. And now I'm finding more and more things to do in them to incorporate it, just not on the entrees or the secondes, but throughout the rest of the dishes in the kitchen.
Right. What is it that oven gives to food that a regular oven doesn't? Like what?
It's just a depth of flavor. It's adding that subtle smoke that's not overly smoky,
mm-hmm.
Where it's just a subtle way to add a tweak of a flavor to something so little that just adds to and helps evolve a dish.
Mm-hmm.
Which is why now, over time, that I'm learning more about them, how I can use them to then add more flavor to other things
uh-huh.
In the kitchen.
And it's a matter of calibrating, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you may just do an element of a dish in there.
Yes.
Okay. Is that unusual? That seems. Is that unusual? I feel like that might be unusual.
To do one element of something.
Yeah. Is it just?
I don't think so.
Maybe
that's just what I'm doing.
Yeah.
But I mean. For the secondes, they're all coming out of the ovens.
Mm-hmm.
So we're smoking the eggplant in there that goes on the new lamb dish.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm trying to find creative ways to use smaller ingredients that go into other dishes out of the ovens, because I think that there's so many things that are capable of happening, whether it's dehydrating peppers that go into the hot sauce that
uh-huh.
we use on the brunch menu.
Got it.
It's slowly trying to learn more about the ovens to then make it a fluid throughout the menu.
Okay. And what's the once you kind of learn how to use it and get comfortable, is it still a daily sort of triage situation with the heat and the wood and the... I mean, I grill a fair amount at home.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not a professional cook, but I feel like even if I grill like 3 nights in a row, every night's a little bit different.
It's all a little bit different. Sometimes the wood is more dry when it comes mm-hmm. in, so the oven, it takes a little bit longer for the oven to get hot.
Right.
It's definitely a lot like anything in the kitchen where you need to do it repeatedly. Like there's hot spots on flat tops that you get used to, and it's very similar to that. I mean, dealing with fire is definitely a little bit more daunting.
Mm-hmm.
But as you do it over and over again, I mean, I can look at the ovens during service mm-hmm. and know that my fish cook should have put a piece of wood on 10 minutes before.
Okay.
Because it's now dying down.
Right.
So it's just like anything in a kitchen. It's about doing it over and over again.
Yeah.
And then you learn where the fire needs to be in order to make the porgy to cook slowly,
yes.
but properly.
Yes.
Same thing with the pans in there. It's having your seasoned cast irons ready to rock. So it's just about doing it over and over again.
Okay. Do you have a favorite type of food to cook? Meat, fish, vegetable? Like, do you have a favorite personal thing?
I mean, I'd have to say pasta is probably my favorite thing to cook, which is definitely a large focus here.
Sure.
And the program and the menu.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Right now, it's definitely a balance between the pastas and also the wood ovens because
mm-hmm.
I'm still intrigued. I think just like making pasta, you never know everything. Everything's subtly different every day.
Yeah.
Like how much water you need to add.
And you like that.
I love that. I think that keeps you engaged. I think that keeps you super interested.
Yeah.
I say repetition, not in a bad way of how we do things in a kitchen, but there's always things that are a little bit different. Like sometimes things take more salt. Sometimes you need more water to hydrate the pasta. Sometimes it needs to sit longer.
Yes.
With pasta, especially since we make everything here by hand, sometimes it takes 5 minutes to cook. Sometimes it takes 7.
Yeah.
Which it's a guessing game, but it's a good guessing game.
Yeah. Pasta's so personal, isn't it?
I
think it's one of the most personal things. I keep running across people either in conversation or interviews for this show who like they won't eat pasta in other if they run an Italian restaurant. Like Tony Mantuano was on the show recently,
mm-hmm.
and he said what a lot of people said to me, which is he almost never eats pasta in another chef's restaurant because he's so particular about it.
I went through a phase like that
a few
years ago where I didn't want to eat anyone's pasta. And now all I want to do is try other people's pasta and
just
see what they're doing.
To see what you can learn from it
See what I can learn or see what they're doing that could spark an interest in something I could tweak here. Or I think it helps with creativity.
And you get those revelations from it.
Yeah.
It actually delivers on that goal.
Yeah, because then you're trying to figure out what made that amazing. Like, what made that dish someplace else so good?
Mm-hmm.
I love eating other... I really love going out and eating other people's pasta.
This is kind of your thing now?
Yeah. Okay. I mean, our local place that my husband and I go to, it's called Rucola.
Oh,
and
sure.
I always get a bowl of one of their pastas.
Yeah.
I also like that when I can go out with one of my sous chefs, it's like, let's go someplace. It's either completely different from here, or it's like, let's go to... My husband works at Lilia. I love going to Lilia and eating her pasta. And then
Works at Lilia?
Yeah.
That's a little close for comfort.
He hasn't always... He's been there. He was a bartender there before we opened here.
Okay.
I love seeing what other people are doing pasta-wise.
I love that. I don't think I'm wrong though. I think that's unusual.
It might be. I don't know.
I think it is. I love that. That seems to me like the former student in you.
I do have to be in the mood for it though.
Mm-hmm.
Cause there are days if I have time to go out and eat where I'm like, I want nothing Italian.
Cause your senses are sort of saturated from all the garlic and just in the air.
And it's nice to be immersed in other cuisines and
mm-hmm.
other flavors and stuff and ingredients that I don't use here.
Yeah.
So I have to be in the mood to do pasta, but I don't shy away from it.
Yes.
Because sometimes all I want is the comfort of a bowl of pasta.
Right. Okay,
so that isn't my own.
Point of privilege as the host of the show, I need to ask you. You don't have to answer me. You didn't know I was going to ask this. What? Do you know what I'm going to ask
you? No, no, I'm scared though.
I think you were here the night I was here. The first time I came in, I had the meatballs here. Mm-hmm. Did my compliment make it to you? I thought they were the best meatballs I'd ever had anywhere.
Well, I love it right now.
I don't know if that made it back to you.
I don't remember. I think you were here pretty early. What? Or it was in the winter.
It was maybe February.
Was it when you were in with Lauren?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, I remember. You guys sat right over here.
Yeah.
I think you actually came back and told me that.
I think I did.
I think you did.
I think that's all I had time. It was Saturday night. Yeah. You were like slammed.
Right.
But we ordered them, and then I ordered a second order.
You ordered
order.
Them again.
Yeah.
Right, right, right.
Yeah. So can I ask anything about them?
I just wanted to do.
Is it proprietary?
No, I mean, I just wanted to do a pork meatball. So it was, all right, let's do a pork meatball.
Yeah.
What can we put in there?
Yeah.
Well, there definitely needs to be bread soaked in milk.
Okay.
Some standards, you know, and Parmesan cheese.
Yeah.
And then it's like, well, what flavors do we add in? I was like, how about some fennel? How about this? How about that? And then, like, we just, it was my sous chefs and I, and we just did, I got in 5 pounds of pork.
Yeah.
And then it's like, let's do, everyone do something. So we all did something different, and then we took what we liked from each one.
You mean everyone made a meatball?
Yeah.
Okay.
It was like, same thing with a lot of the stuff. Some of the things that I couldn't quite get on my own, that I wasn't doing well in my apartment, which is where I did most of the menu testing. It was, okay, guys, we're going to do meatballs. So we each did one, and then we talked about them, and then we took the stuff we liked from
each
one of them.
So this was sort of an amalgamation of all the, how many people are we talking about?
Two sous chefs.
Okay.
So I think we did many different versions of a meatball.
Well, I got to tell you, I think about them. There's not that many foods. Years ago, I wanted to write an article, Destination Dishes, because people were talking about destination restaurants.
Right.
And I'm telling everyone, listen, those, are they on now?
Yeah.
Oh my God. I love those meatballs. How often do you change it up here at the menu?
Since December, we're now going through the third.
Okay.
The third menu change.
Uh-huh.
I'd like to do it 6 or 7 times a year, just depending on the availability of what's at the market.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like between spring and summer, there was nothing available for summer. Then all of a sudden, everything was
it's
available
like an explosion.
Summer.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So it's really, as the seasons change, we have the early summer stuff. So we don't really have tomatoes yet, but we'll do another change in a few weeks to add more tomatoes when we can.
Okay.
It's pretty much based on when produce becomes available.
Okay.
I mean, we do have some staple stuff that I haven't changed yet.
Yeah.
And some dishes I probably won't change.
Okay.
I'd like to keep a few staple items.
Yeah.
But for the most part, I'd like to do it based on when availability
got it
at the market is.
Okay. Do you have a favorite season?
I love fall.
You do?
Mm-hmm.
You like that that shift?
Yeah. I'm mostly excited for fall in the beginning of winter. It's because it'll be the first time we'll be almost a year at that point.
So you've gone through that cycle.
Yeah, so I'm really excited to see where and how different and how I can tweak what we did when we opened, which I think is going to be completely different. Because as the seasons have changed, I've been really excited with the evolution of the menu and the menu items and becoming more creative about what we can do.
It's so funny because I feel like this is something we have in common because I consider I said this on the show a few weeks ago. I consider myself a tweaker. I love doing that with stuff.
Right.
I love that process that maybe it never ends. You like that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you have
an idea where that comes from?
I love change, but change also scares me. So I like that and that sort of element of fear involved in it. Like, what are we going to do in 2 weeks when tomatoes are available? Or it's that thing that's always in your head that always scares you a little bit. That's what I like.
Uh-huh.
I like the not knowing of what things are going to become, whether it's something that's on the menu or it's completely changing things or X, Y, and Z. I like that sort of fear element and the anticipation of what something could be.
Well, good sitting down with you.
Thank you.
Thanks for your time. And I look forward to coming in and eating in the fall.
Yeah, gotta get those meatballs again.
Okay, thanks. And that's our show, and that is our season. Caitlin, thank you for being with me again.
Always a pleasure, Andrew.
Do you know that our next season will be the beginning of our next year? That'll be the one-year anniversary next. Already.
No way.
Yeah, it's been a year. It was a year ago this week that Evan Sung took that photograph of me that is the identifying photo of the show.
What? How many have you done?
We're in the low 40s.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
Congratulations.
Thank you. I'm trying to think what to do for my 50th. I'm trying to think of a big... I have some thoughts of kind of pie in the sky guests I'm going to see if I can get. So
that's
I don't
exciting.
Want to say it on the air, but I don't know if they'll do it. But people that might do it. So I think 50 is a big number. Deserves a... I'm not going to go through a life crisis like I did for my own personal 50th.
I was actually like, no, please, no. We just did this.
Anyway, like I said, everybody, if you want to hear more episodes in the next month, just rate the show or review the show on iTunes. And for each 25, there will be another show dropped. And if my book, Chef's Drugs and Rock and Roll, spikes up into the top 1,000 on Amazon, I'll drop another show for that as well until I run out. But I don't think I'll run out. I think I've got plenty in the bank for those two requests. And otherwise, David Tatasciore, our engineer, thank you, David, for all your help this season. As always, to the team at Heritage, you guys have been the best. And to all of you out there in podcast land, thank you for listening. And we will see you back in September, although I hope sooner, on Andrew Talks to Chefs.